This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with Sean Griffith about his amazing new book, Facing the U.S. Prison Population, 2.3 Million Strong.
Just out of prison 6 months ago, he wrote a powerful book on what's wrong with our prison system and how they must be changed.
We'll talk with Francis Boyle about the recent UN vote giving Palestine observer status.
What does it mean for Palestine? Can they join the International Criminal Court? The World Court? Can they bring charges against Israel? Here are the answers from Professor Boyle, who has advised the Palestinian Authority.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael Ratner, the trial of Bradley Manning has been going on for quite some time down in Maryland, and you went down there last week to observe it. And I wanted to ask you, what was it like down there?
Well, it's the trial in a way. What we have are pretrial proceedings. In the Bradley Manning case, people, of course, recall Bradley Manning is PFC Bradley Manning, private first class, who allegedly uploaded to WikiLeaks, my client, the center's client, millions of documents regarding the Iraq War, Afghan War, collateral murder video. And what I think really gave him the heat and Julian Assange the heat was the 250,000 secret diplomatic cables illustrating the criminality, hypocrisy, and corruption of our wonderful State Department. The hearing has been going on for a while. He's been charged with aiding the enemy in various computer crimes. The pretrial hearings concern a number of issues, everything from classification and evidence to speedy trial. They go on about 3 to 6 days a month. The trial now is scheduled for March, the court-martial rather, takes place at Fort Meade. I spent a day in the last week or so down there, and I happened to be there on the most dramatic day probably I've ever spent in a courtroom. On that day, Bradley Manning was asked to testify about the pretrial detention, the cruel abuse of treatment and torture that he underwent for 2.5 years, but really during the first year after he was arrested in Iraq in late May of 2010. And it's a long story. I'll try and summarize it for this update. He was first taken from Iraq to Kuwait. In Kuwait, he was put into what you would have to call, what he called, an animal cage, 8 foot by 8 foot by 8 foot. It was in a tent. He was in this cage with a sort of a bed, a rack off the side, I guess a toilet off the side. He was awakened every day in the cage at 11 at night, kept up all night, and then allowed to sleep starting at 1 in the afternoon. His description of being in the cage was that his whole world, a world in which Bradley Manning was interested, from the Gulf oil spill to all kinds of other subjects, just was closed now into an animal cage. And he thought he would die in that cage after 2 months in that cage. The other impression I got, and then we'll go to the next part, the other impression of Bradley Manning when he took the stand, he was in a good-looking dark blue dress uniform with a white shirt and a tie. And his dignity on the witness stand was almost unparalleled in my view of seeing witnesses in a courtroom. He described what happened to him with great intelligence, great self-awareness, and nothing like the weak flake that he's been painted as in the media. This is a strong human being who is smart, knows what's going on, and really described what happened to him in such vivid detail that the 20 or 30 of us that can fit into this tiny windowless courtroom at Fort Meade were basically in tears. So there you have Kuwait. From Kuwait, he is sent to Quantico. You always want to say Guantanamo because actually they sound the same, but in fact, he was treated like a Guantanamo detainee. He's sent to Quantico in Virginia. When he's put on the plane, you know, he's shackled up in what they call the three-piece suit, which is around the legs, the belly, you know, the waist and his arms. He's sent to Quantico in Virginia. When he gets on the plane, he doesn't know where he's going. He thinks it could be Guantanamo. I mean, they never tell him anything. He doesn't know anything. Eventually, he gets off the plane at Quantico, and he's relieved to be at Quantico compared to Guantanamo. And maybe he thought it was going to be better than a cage in Kuwait. It didn't get better. It was 9 months, and again I'll summarize, 9 months of what you would have to call part of the Rumsfeld torture conditions that were imposed on Guantanamo detainees. So he's put into a prison cell, but it's solitary. It's on a road where there's nobody else. There's a 24-hour light into the cell. It's 8x6. There's an observation booth right across. There's someone sitting on a chair. And he got off the stand and was very dramatic to draw out on the floor of the courtroom, if you want to call this tiny room a courtroom, the size of the cell, 8x6. The lawyer, David Coombs, who's doing an excellent job, had him put on a suicide smock, which he was forced to wear with no clothes underneath it, night. A suicide smock goes down to your feet. It's made up of a stiff material. It's like a straitjacket, except goes to your feet, but his arms aren't bound in front of him.
So are his arms inside the enclosure?
His arms
are... That must be incredibly claustrophobic.
His arms are actually allowed outside, oh, okay. But one night they got caught inside. He couldn't get out, and so they had to go and rescue him out of the suicide smock. I can go into more detail about that, but in the end, what you see here is you have him in solitary, in this small cell, looking out onto a light 24 hours a day. So during the night to sleep, he has to sleep in the suicide smock. He has to face the light all the time on his bunk, or else the guards come in and turn him around. If he faces the wall to try and get away from the light, they turn him around, so he has to face the light. So he has a light on him 24 hours, even when he's sleeping. He has to face it. So he's in a suicide smock facing the light. He has no items of hygiene. So if he wants toilet paper, he has to go to the front of the cell and say, PFC Manning requests toilet paper from Lance Corporal X. And sometimes they'll just ignore him. He'll stand there waiting for toilet paper, etc. So you can imagine. And he's naked at night, except for the suicide smock. During the day, he's only allowed to wear his underpants. And for a couple of days, he was naked completely. And they actually had a video of it where they showed him being forced to take off his clothes, put them in one of those like mail slots that has a little tray in the center of the bars of the cell, and giving his clothes to the three big, beefy, camouflaged Marines who are on the other side. He's Army, but for some reason, they put him in a Marine barrack, which you can imagine. So that's his situation in this cell for 9 months. And what's interesting, the U.S. claims that he was on a suicide watch, that he was a war preventative injury watch, and that's why these conditions were required. Well, these conditions I don't think are even required of people on suicide watch. But the other testimony we heard was the psychiatrists, who were very competent, I have to say. They were good enough for anybody I've heard is a psychiatrist.
Are these government psychiatrists?
Yes, government psychiatrists. One of them, head of forensic psychiatry at Walter Meade, he treated Bradley Manning. He said while he was at Quantico, I recommended numerous times to the brig commander that he be taken out of that cell, that it was hurting him, it was depressing him to be in that situation, that he was not a suicide threat, and that he had no more likelihood of suicide than any other member of that population. And it was the first time in his memory that his direction or his request to a brig commander was ever turned down. And that was the repeated testimony of psychiatrists. So there was no reason for it other than the reason being to try and punish him before trial, or to get him to turn against my and the center's client, Julian Assange, and to try and get him to implicate Julian Assange in something which we don't know, because we don't know if he knows anything about Julian Assange at all. So we don't know. So these conditions, and I'll summarize what they are, these are what we call Rumsfeld techniques. Stripping was something that Rumsfeld recommended for people at Guantanamo. Lights 24 hours a day, Guantanamo. Sleep disruption, Guantanamo. Solitary, Guantanamo. So while, yes, it didn't include waterboarding, it didn't include those kinds of things, but included at least a half a dozen, or at least four or five of what we call sensory deprivation, which are made to break down a person's humanity and his humanness. And that's what these were about. I'll close by just saying, when you saw Bradley Manning that day, it was just remarkable. As I started by saying, his dignity, his self-awareness, his efforts to get himself out from this situation by appealing to every entity he could in the prison, he has a counselor that comes and sees him. And the counselor lied to him. The counselor lied to him all the time. The counselor says, well, I don't see why you're in here. If I had 100 prisoners like you in here, we wouldn't have any problems in this prison. All the time, it was the counselor and the brig keeping him in, and his psychiatrist, who the counselor said, you have to talk to, they have to get you out of here. The counselor was lying. The psychiatrist said out. The brig and the counselor were essentially lying to Bradley Manning. So what will happen? And let's talk about that, and we'll end on that. The lawyer for Bradley Manning is asking for dismissal of all the charges because of what you'd call dirty hands or dirty torture by the United States. Well, that's unlikely. He's been charged with aiding the enemy, life sentence. It's always possible if a government acts dirty enough and abusive enough that a charge can be dismissed. I think that's unlikely. If that doesn't happen, the lawyer has said for every day he spent, almost a year, in these kind of horrible conditions, we want 10 days off his sentence for each day, which is 7 or 8 years off whatever sentence, which might be a very long sentence in this case. The last point, he got transferred to Leavenworth in April of 2011 due to the huge protests, including, as people will recall, a man named Crawley resigning from the Department of State because he said, I don't think Bradley Manning ought to be treated like that. And he was forced to resign. This is the spokesperson for the Department of State. As soon as Bradley Manning is transferred to Leavenworth in Kansas, he is immediately put into the general population. And the woman in charge of the prison at Leavenworth testified there was nothing wrong with him. We transferred him immediately to general population. He was at the lowest classification he could be in. And we never have kept anybody on suicide watch for more than 48 to 72 hours. So there you go. What the United States government did to Bradley Manning was torture. It was a crime. And the people who did it, those are the ones that should be on trial as we speak.
As listeners may know, the United States has incarcerated more people than any other country in the world, and also within the history of humanity. The newly published book titled Facing the U.S. Prison System, 2.3 Million Strong, by Sean Griffith, gives the reader a rare perspective from an ex-convict who served a 20-year sentence in some of the harshest conditions. He was confined to a small cement cell in the late Florida summer without sheets, laying in pools of sweat on a plastic-covered mattress. Vindictive prison guards and some caseworkers made life nearly unbearable for Sean Griffith. The book offers a series of practical ways that we can change this system. Sean, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Tell us briefly about your background and what led you to write what is truly a remarkable book.
When I was younger, I was raised as a Catholic, and it was somewhat of an abusive home. I'd like to say, too, that I've made amends with my mom. My dad has passed. I have made amends with my mom, and, you know, we have a good relationship today. But as a youngster, it was a very difficult childhood, and early on, I wondered why, if my parents were very religious, and there was a lot of physical abuse or some alcoholism, things like that going on in the family. So early on, I kind of went on this kind of truth-seeking thing where I started studying a number of things in history, religion, philosophy, and different things, and started kind of just getting an idea of why those things were happening. Unfortunately, I also became very rebellious at a young age because of the abuse, and I went into a hospital for 2.5 years at the age of 12. The circumstances are very detailed, so I'll save that for another time, but I got out of the hospital when the insurance ran out. They said I was all well. I hit the street at 16. I met these people who were crack cocaine addicts. They were the only ones I could find a place where I could stay off the street. They offered me a place. Then they introduced me to the drug, which I had no knowledge of how addictive it was. And then they told me that I had to help them support their habit. And they started training me, taking me to different homes and things, showing me how to burglarize them, steal cars, a number of things to support our habits. And that kind of led, once I broke that barrier of breaking the law and I was on, you know, the crack cocaine, it really had a negative effect on my conscience. And from that point, it was really downhill from about 17 till 21. And when I committed an armed robbery for $100 and in the end ended up with a 24-year sentence, of which I did 20 years.
While you were in prison there in Florida, did you start educating yourself and start writing this book?
Well, what I did at first is I knew that I had some emotional problems. So at first I studied psychology in depth for about 4 years. I did an in-depth personal rehabilitation. And I also had a friend named Alan Kurzrock, who was an art therapist and psychologist who was very influential on me. He kind of became my father mentor. And that was early on, and I still had a lot of rebellion. Ended up, you know, by the age of 23, I had attempted to escape when I was in prison initially. I couldn't face the amount of time. To me, that was like a life sentence at that age. And I attempted to escape, and one day I was in a confinement cell. It was like a dungeon underground. It was very depressing. I had been caught with some escape paraphernalia. And one day I just realized that I faced it. You know, Alan's influence and some other people just kind of hit me at that point. I was like, you know, what am I doing here? I mean, I'm going to end up hurting someone or hurting myself or getting hurt, you know, trying to escape. I've got to face my problems. So that day I wrote my deceased brother, only brother who had been killed in 1988 on a motorcycle, and I wrote him a poem, and I promised him in that poem that from that day forward, I was going to find a way to change my life. And I did. I never stopped. I went into studying psychology, and then from psychology, I moved into taking Ohio University courses and a number of other things. I just studied for like 18 years straight, and I just refused to give up. I didn't want to have a life that was a criminal lifestyle for my whole life. I knew that I could do better. I believe that, and so I pursued it very, very hard.
Sean, your book is called Facing the U.S. Prison Problem, 2.3 Million Strong, an ex-con's view of the mistakes and the solutions. Why do you think the U.S. prison system has really burgeoned so rapidly over the past several decades?
Well, there's a number of reasons. One of the primary reason is special interests behind the scene. That's the primary reason. The secondary reason is that families of prisoners have no unified vote or unified voice. The prisoners inside and behind the walls, they're voiceless, they're voteless. Policymakers who have special interests that wish to see the prison system expand, you know, there's nothing to stop them. So unionized guards, you know, chapters of large national unions, correctional associations, and a number of corporations that buy the influence through large campaign donations. I have a number of examples in the book where CCA, GO, and some of the large correctional officer unions, such as the CCPOA in California, the PBA used to be in Florida, and I think that it now is the Teamsters Union. You know, they are very influential behind the scenes, and as long as laws continue to be passed, three strikes laws and 1020 life, like we have in Florida, the three strikes in California, a number of those kind of laws, they increase the population because that increases the need for more prison construction, which then increases the membership numbers of the unions and the overall, you know, profits of the large corporations that are building these prisons. There are a number of other influences as well, but those are primarily the causes behind the scene.
Sean, are you saying that there was no real increase in crime that caused the burgeoning of the prison population? It was something else.
There was no increase in crime in these time periods. We look from 1975 forward, and the crime rates have actually decreased significantly, and that's at the same time that crime reporting has gone up significantly. So sometimes the numbers get skewed, and there are those special interests that report in certain media outlets the crime has increased. That's not the case at all. The reporting of the crime has increased because people are much more familiar with how to report and feel a little more comfortable now reporting to the police. A lot of the minority communities are, for a long time, did not report crime. There's been a lot more reporting, but much less crime as overall in the nation. And I did an analysis of that in Florida in Chapter 1, where I explained in detail where some of the sentencing laws that were passed in Florida, those same laws that were passed show decreases in crime rates before the laws were even instituted. So a lot of people say, oh, it's, you know, the tough-on-crime politicians and the laws that have been passed in Florida and Texas and some of these, you know, actually the majority of the states in the country, you know, they've been passed because of increased crime rates, but that is not true.
I think you're right. The privatization factor is a huge reason why we've seen such a growth in the system. And one of the other things related are changes in the penal system itself, increased restrictions related to educational opportunities, nutrition, medical. You detail in a harrowing example your experience with medical negligence. Why do you think inmates are treated in conditions that arise to torture?
Well, I think it comes back to the same reason. I mean, inmates and their families, first off, families of inmates, the majority of them are below the poverty line. So they don't really have a lot of resources to fight back. They don't have a voice themselves in most cases because they're not unionized. One of the things that I've shown is that these large groups that influence the correction system through political maneuvers, they are unionized. They do have votes, and those votes are very important to those politicians. And the money and the membership dues and the profits from the large corporations that are in the privatization area, you know, they have the votes and the money. The families don't. So when it comes to cost, one of the first things that's going to be cut is the medical treatment, nutritional standards, and things of that nature, because the public out here is really, and I don't say this in a disparaging way, but they're really ignorant to what's going on inside. The only thing they know is that we're increasing debt, the deficit's getting worse, and, you know, these criminals, what do they deserve? You know, they don't deserve, you know, color TVs and air conditioning, which is truly a falsehood, because 99% of the prison, state prisons in the United States do not have air conditioning. And any TVs that they have been donated, usually by families or, you know, other groups and churches that are concerned. So that's really what it comes down to, even nutrition and medical standards. When it comes to cutting the money, the first thing they're going to cut is the benefits to the prisoners and their families. The last thing they're going to cut is, you know, the aspects of security, which is an easy sell. And the courts, what's a shame is the courts, in most cases, have supported these policies. I mean, when it comes to penal security, that is pretty much rises above any other concern. And who's gonna push to get these things changed? There is nobody to push. I mean, there really is no unionized group to push back.
What are we going to do about this? What can people who are concerned about the fact that the United States has more prisoners than any other country in the world relative to its population, and absolutely 2.3 million prisoners, what can we do about this? Let them out early, let them out when they're younger, give them parole. I mean, what are your ideas about this?
Well, that's a very complex question. One of the things I think that first, and you, this program and some other programs are helping to do that, is to shed some light on these abuses. And one of the things I mentioned in there, and it's, I know that I believe Michael Ratner addressed the issues with Guantanamo Bay and some of the foreign detainees. And until we get the same kind of media attention on prisoners in America and what's going on to them, their families, and especially their children, we're really not going to have a lot of change, because people just don't know. If we can get enough media attention on these things and spotlight them, then what we need to do, I think, first and foremost, is get family members and activists and reformers together under a national umbrella, just like the major unions do and just like some of these groups do that serve the private industry. If we can do that, then we can implement some policies. I have 10 of the top legislative and other agendas that I am trying to push in the book in Chapter 10. It's under the Prisoner Family Union, which is what we're trying to develop. I would like to read those real quickly, if I could. They're just 10 points.
Go ahead.
Yeah, please do.
Okay. Number one, sentencing reforms that place ceilings on sentences, increase judges' discretion to make downward departures, increase drug treatment and other community corrections alternatives, and abolish minimum mandatory provisions for nonviolent offenses. That's number one. Pursue policies of prisoner placement that reduce current intrastate distances by 40% and completely abolish nonvoluntary interstate placements. Three, pursue the reversal of corrections policies that diminish prisoners' familial contact for disciplinary purposes. Increase weekly video conferencing for children and incarcerated parents, in addition to normal contact visitation. Also establish comprehensive private health care plans to augment Medicaid and children of prisoners. Number four, lobby the legislators to pass laws that reverse pen pal and religious correspondence restrictions and other policies of isolation, while instituting other safeguards to ensure societal and penological security. Number five, seek the abolishment of policies that charge co-payments, reimbursements, and other double taxation charges to prisoners' tax-paying loved ones. This would include the pursuit of fair collect call rates and profit margins on the commercial resale of all goods and services. Six, pursue programs of inexpensive electronic video communications between prisoners and their children. Seven, seek increases in rehabilitative activities such as music, artwork, writing, and hobby craft that can be leveraged to reduce solitary confinement and visitation restrictions as positive behavioral incentives. That one is very important, because right now what's happening is across the United States, they're increasing restrictions on visitation. And that just increases recidivism, because the lower the decrease in family relationships between these prisoners is paramount to reducing their returns to prison. So 7 is very important. Number 8, present the statistics in support of increased drug and alcohol treatment programs and make early release credit dependent on successful participatory recovery. Number 9, lobby state and federal leaders to institute mandatory GED classes and increase vocational and higher educational opportunities for prisoners. And 10, implement agricultural, industrial, and service economies that increase training and financial incentives inside the prisons. This increased work ethic would decrease the burden on taxpayers through reduction of recidivism and corrections expenditures. So those are our top 10. They're very in-depth, and I could probably go on and on about just one or two of them.
We'd like you to do that, but let me first just remind our audience that we're speaking with Sean R. Griffith, who has just had published a very fine book called Facing the U.S. Prison Problem, 2.3 Million Strong, an ex-con's view of the mistakes and the solutions. Sean, go on and elaborate then, if you'd like, on some of the points you just made.
Okay. Let's see. I'll pick number 1. Because I think that one's one of the top priorities. The pursue criminal justice sentencing reforms to place ceilings on sentences and increase judges' discretion to make downward departures, increase drug treatment and other community corrections alternatives, and abolish minimum mandatory provisions for nonviolent offenses. Basically, the crux of all of the special interest groups are the source and the financial cause of the majority of the burgeoning prison system as it is now. At the same time, the people that implement those things are the judges, the prosecutors, and in many cases, the public defenders. So what I would say is once we get a large enough union to where we can lobby the legislatures in these states and the federal legislature as well, you know, the sentencing schemes that they have right now are just ridiculous. I mean, most of the people in these state prisons are nonviolent prisoners. I mean, prisons initially were established, the history of prisons were initially were established to put away people who are a severe threat to society, who cannot be rehabilitated, or if they can be rehabilitated, they need the corrections of a prison and strong rehabilitative policies inside there and incentives to teach a work ethic and help through their psychological issues that they have. And every prisoner that I've met has psychological issues. So in order to do those things, once we get the legislature to start passing those laws, then the judges need to be given more discretion. For instance, in Florida, I have one of the judges in Florida actually gave me a review on the back of the book. And, you know, Judge Stancil, he is a strong proponent of giving judges back some discretion. Because right now the prosecutors basically have complete authority to implement the sentences that they wish. And they do it out of convenience. They do it for political purposes. And a lot of times it's not directly related to what the crime is. I mean, even in my situation, whenever I was sentenced to 22 years for a $100 non-injurious robbery. No one was harmed. It was obviously I had a very bad childhood and upbringing. My situation on the street at the time, I was starving, I was homeless, and I was desperate and a drug addict. And, you know, none of these things were really taken into consideration. They did everything they could do to slam me and put me in there for as long as they could. It was a plea bargain. The 22 years was a plea bargain. The only other thing they offered me was a life sentence. You see the product that I've provided in this book and the things that I'm trying to achieve. Imagine if they had given me a life sentence, which I was only one step away from. You know, the sentencing is one of the main things that needs to be addressed first.
Sean, I just wanted to say that I think what you've just discussed, as well as other points in the book, really is a searing indictment about what's happened in this country. A disproportionate emphasis on punishment and a failure to acknowledge that rehabilitation, education are really what will hold this society together in a positive fashion. And what are you doing now? You're involved with a group called Prisoner Family Union. Can you briefly tell us about that and how people can contact you?
Well, first off, I'd like to say that if people are interested in contacting me or in purchasing the book, they can go to my first website, speakoutpublishing.com. And so, there's no way we can address even 10% of what the book, I'm sure you guys know you've read it, but so they can contact me there. The Prisoner Family Union is basically a union of family members and activists and reformers that I'm trying to develop. I've only been out for 6 months from prison.
Wait, you've only been out 6 months?
I've only been out 6 months, and I have been...
That's unbelievable. I mean, you know...
So busy. I researched all of the book pretty much when I was in prison, and then I went on a writing spree immediately when I got out and published within 3 months. Unfortunately, financially, it's I'm not in a very good situation because I just got out 6 months ago. I have been basically living off of a loan. I've only sold 30 copies of the book thus far.
That's extraordinary. I mean, we ought to have you give lessons to writers who can't write.
Beautifully written.
I mean, that you did this, I'm just in complete shock.
3 months? That's amazing.
I mean, I had no idea. I thought I would have said you'd been out for 6 years, not 6 months. Give us that website again.
It's speakoutpublishing.com. They can also order on Amazon. I would say, though, that the Amazon and those other companies, they take out 95% of the price. I mean, I've spent a loan. I have a loan that I owe now for $25,000 that I had to pay to get this book published and open the publishing company and the websites. Speakoutpublishing.com. The Prisoner Family Union, just to answer your question, Heidi, it's what I'm trying to do. I describe it in detail in Chapter 10. But as I stand right now, I mean, I'm literally worried about paying the rent this month. So I'm hoping that I can get people interested and get them involved through these interviews. We can't do this by ourselves. Neither can you guys or I do this by ourselves. We have to get people's family members, reformers and activists. We have to come together like the groups that are doing these things behind the scenes have come together.
Sean, it's Michael Ratner again. And I just want to say how much we appreciate it and how much I appreciate your mentioning Guantanamo, because I do think everybody got so upset about it. Guantanamo is what's going on in our prisons on a daily basis in the United States. Yeah. And I think that's the strength of this book. And I really encourage our listeners to read this remarkable book, Facing the U.S. Prison Problem, 2.3 Million Strong, An Ex-Con's View of the Mistakes and the Solutions by Sean R. Griffith. I mean, this is a special book. The prison system obviously is getting a lot more attention now than it had in the past, but not much is changing very quickly, and it has to change quickly. And Sean is really one of the best examples of how we can help change it and what we can do to change it. So thank you very much, Sean.
Thank you, Mike.
Sean, you have our great respect and admiration, and good luck to you.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
That Palestine has been voted observer status in the United Nations, Palestinian leaders can join the International Court of Justice and the International Criminal Court and challenge Israel's violations of international law. We talk today with Professor Francis Boyle, the leading expert in international law, about his role as the legal advisor to the Palestinian Authority. In his book, Palestine, Palestinians and International Law, Professor Boyle lays out 6 critical areas where the Palestinians can take advantage of international law to further their interests against the encroachments of the Israeli state.
Professor Boyle, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you very much for having me on, Heidi, and my best to your listening audience out there, and simply to commend the National Lawyers Guild and also all the fine work you do and Michael Ratner, all the great work the Center for Constitutional Right does, and I'm very happy to be here with both of you.
Thank you. Now, we'd like to talk about the recent vote concerning Palestine. Can you explain exactly what it was and what it means?
Yes. What happened was, back in 2010, the negotiations between the Israelis and the Palestinians broke off because Israel continued to build settlements, and the Palestinians took the position, well, you know, we're negotiating over a pizza while you eat it. So I went back to them with a proposal, longstanding with President Arafat, that we apply for membership in the United Nations organization. So that was approved by the PLO Executive Committee, and they spent a year in diplomacy preparing the groundwork. President Abbas appeared at the United Nations then in 2011 and submitted the application, getting four or five standing ovations in his speech. And then the Obama administration bottled the application up in the Security Council. The mainstream news media has it wrong. Obama can exercise a veto over their admission if they want to, but under the Uniting for Peace procedure, they can then turn it over to the General Assembly, where Palestine could be admitted as a full-fledged member state by a two-thirds vote. To make a long story short, I believe after further consultations, they concluded that would be a bridge too far. So they took an intermediate step. Last spring, the PLO Executive Committee that serves as the provisional government for the state of Palestine, created by the November 15, 1988 Palestinian Declaration of Independence, voted to apply for UN observer state status this fall. This would be along the lines of the status Switzerland had from the founding of the United Nations organization until about 10 years ago or so, when Switzerland finally decided to become a UN member state. So President Abbas came out for that, presented it. They delayed a vote until after the presidential elections, decided to schedule the vote on November 29, the day of the partition resolution adopted by the General Assembly back in 1947 that created this entire problem in the first place, and figuring that the General Assembly owed them. As you can see, the vote was 138 in favor, I think 9 against, and several of those were simply U.S. colonial satrapies, and then the others abstaining, which also proves then that if and when the PLO decides to go back for full-fledged U.N. membership, which if you read the resolution, they said they are preserving their right to do so, they would have the two-thirds vote in the U.N. General Assembly under the Uniting for Peace resolution to get admitted as a full-fledged member state.
Sure. I want to slow you down for 1 second because I want to understand what the status means for them. What's the technical name for the status?
A United Nations observer state. If you want a shorthand, Michael, just look at everything Switzerland did from the founding of the United Nations until about 10 years ago as a UN observer state. Palestine can now, if it wishes, join pretty much every international organization in the world and treaties. So they would have, you know, the same rights as Switzerland, and would simply use the Swiss model, for example, join the International Criminal Court, join the International Court of Justice, sue Israel at the World Court, join the Law of the Sea Convention, join the International Civil Aviation Organization.
No, remarkable, Francis. I'm quite amazed by this.
What could the Palestinians conceivably get through their new affiliations with these various organizations?
Start with the International Criminal Court.
Right. Well, in fact, Michael, we already filed a complaint with the International Criminal Court after Operation Cast Lead. And I want to make it clear, I say we, but I'm not authorized to speak for the PLO. But in any event, I advised this step to President Abbas, which he took. And we did accept the jurisdiction of the International Criminal Court under Article 12, Paragraph 3 of the Rome Statute. Now, what happened is that the ICC prosecutor at that time, Moreno Ocampo, no longer there, announced in a statement two points. One, that he was going to investigate the capacity of Palestine to accept the jurisdiction of the court. And then two, he was going to investigate whether Israel had committed war crimes and crimes against humanity during Operation Cast Lead, which, as you know, they exterminated about 1,400 Palestinians, maybe two-thirds of them were civilians. The answer to the second question came out, yes, in the Goldstone Commission report that, in fact, Israel had committed war crimes and crimes against humanity in Operation Cast Lead. But just before he left office, Moreno Ocampo copped out and said that he was not in a position to determine whether Palestine was a state that could accept the ICC jurisdiction under Article 12, Paragraph 3, despite the fact that Palestine, a year ago, now almost, had obtained membership, state membership in UNESCO, which is a UN specialized agency.
So this is when Ocampo left the ICC. He had issued this ruling that there's no jurisdiction, essentially, in the ICC or something like that.
They did not have jurisdiction
right.
under Article 12, Paragraph 3, right. because in his opinion, Palestine did not have state capacity.
But, and so now the question is, will that change with the new vote,
right,
and are they planning to reapply?
Right. What happened then is Friday, the new prosecutor, Ben Souda, said that she was going to look into the implications of the UN observer state designation. So we already have a complaint that was filed. The Palestinians had sent lawyers over there four or five times. I was not part of this delegation or anything. So there's a complaint there on Operation Cast Lead. And I must state, if Moreno Ocampo had accepted the Palestinian complaint, I doubt very seriously the latest, what I call Operation Cast Lead Light, where Netanyahu exterminated 168 Palestinians would have occurred. Because if you follow the Israeli press, they're deathly afraid of prosecution by the ICC. In any event, Ben Souda said she'll revisit this matter. Second, the Palestinians could accept again under Article 12, Paragraph 3. We still have that complaint there on Operation Cast Lead. The other approach the Palestinians could take, they could take both approaches, would be now to ratify the Rome Statute for the International Criminal Court and accept the jurisdiction directly as a contracting state party. The depositary for the treaty is the UN Secretary General. So in light of the action by the UN General Assembly, he would be obligated to accept that instrument of accession to the Rome Statute, as he would be obligated to accept Palestine's instrument of accession to the International Court of Justice, the International Civil Aviation Organization, the Law of the Sea Treaty.
So, Francis, this is a very important vote, in other words, right?
Of course.
Yeah.
Yes, it's not full-fledged UN membership, but Palestine can get all the international rights and standing that Switzerland had until 10 years ago, and that was pretty much everything except UN membership. And I should point out, Palestine already has under previous resolutions by the General Assembly, effectively all the rights of a UN member state except the right to vote. and they've already been given those rights. So the only thing really keeping them out is Obama's threat to veto. But even that is a hollow threat. The Palestinians know it. It's more a question of getting the political support to move for full-fledged UN membership. The step we saw this week, last week, took 2 years in the making. The Palestinians had to go all over the world. President Abbas was flying over the world. Saab Erekat, Hanan Ashwari, to line up that support and to move forward. So this is not something, you know, that they can do without a lot of support around the world.
In addition to joining the Rome Statute and the ICC, the Law of the Sea Convention, you mention the Civil Aviation Organization. Of those several, I believe, six options, could you identify one that might most realistically happen or have a chance of success?
Yes, well, the ICC procedures have already been filed. And so my guess is that that can be reactivated. And indeed, my advice to them already, in light of what Netanyahu did, retaliating against them by announcing the E1 settlements, is that we now file a complaint against the entire settlement policy itself. In the advisory opinion by the International Court of Justice, the World Court ruled that the settlements constitute a violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention of 1949, which is a war crime, and also the Rome Statute itself provides that the transfer of population into occupied territory is a war crime. I think that's Article 8 or something like that. In any event, when war crimes are widespread or systematic, they also constitute a crime against humanity. So in this case, the complaint against the settlement policy would be both for war crimes and crimes against humanity. We already have the complaint in there on Operation Cast Lead. And, you know, it's been my advice we go after the settlements now. But, what they do is really up to them. President Abbas just got back to Palestine on Monday. Yesterday, Tuesday, they voted to return to the United Nations Security Council to get a resolution of condemnation of the settlement policy. My guess is Obama will veto that one.
And almost 100%, Francis. In fact, I'm sure you followed when Hillary's talked to that institute, the Saban Institute. She wouldn't even use the word settlements when she discussed the settlements. She used some other word. So I think you can expect that.
Hillary's on her way out. Whatever this decision is will be made above her pay grade.
Yeah, no, I understand that. I'm just indicating that Hillary is at a certain point, maybe thinking about support in Zionists running for president. But let me ask you, as we have about 20 minutes. I want to get to a question that's related. The reaction to this status that was given to Palestine, but one of them, of course, one we read about, is the death knell two-state solution, because Israel said they're not going to build in the E1 area, which will separate any, quote, second Palestinian state, any Palestinian state from East Jerusalem, separate Ramallah from East Jerusalem. What do you make of that? Was that really more important than all the settlements, you know, that have been going on already? There's 600,000 settlers already. I mean, does the E1 thing tip it differently? Hasn't the two-state solution been going downhill pretty fast anyway?
Well, of course, you're right about that, Michael. But let me get back to the previous question asked by Heidi on other legal steps. The second legal step that I have recommended to the Palestinians, which I think your audience would be interested in, and they are actively considering it, and indeed Hanan Ashwari and Saab Erekat have already publicly stated this, is to sue Israel at the International Court of Justice in The Hague, the so-called World Court of the United Nations system. I've offered to do this work for them and try to break that genocidal siege of Gaza. So those are the two, to get back to Heidi's point, those are the two legal steps that I know are at the top of their agenda, because you have Hanan and Saab publicly stating they are considering these options. Now, to get back to your point on E1, what can I say? You've had Hanan and Saab Erekat, President Abbas, all the rest of them saying the longer these settlements continue, the less likely a two-state solution will be. And, E1 is going to take some time to carry out. Maybe this was just a shot across the bow by Netanyahu. He has an election coming up in January. I don't know. But now, as an observer state, a UN observer state, Palestine has its own shots across the bow, and indeed more than that, that it could launch at Israel. And I submit that the its recognition as a UN observer state was a severe blow to Israel. And again, if you read the Israeli press, it's all over there. Now, one state versus two states, as you know, there is a history here. The 1947 partition resolution, the majority report called for two states, but there was a minority report that called for one state with a federal arrangement. Now, the PLO's position from its founding until 1988, the Declaration of Independence, was that there would be one secular democratic state for the entire mandate of Palestine. Now, that was changed in the 1988 Declaration of Independence. I served as legal advisor to Chairman Arafat and the PLO on that. And it was Chairman Arafat's decision himself to put in the Palestinian Declaration of Independence of 1988 a recognition, an official recognition of the partition resolution of 1947, two states. You can read that declaration in my book, Palestine, Palestinians, and International Law. My book has the official English language translation of the Palestinian declaration that was authorized by the PLO and undertaken by the late Edward Said. Other versions come from a UN translation that deliberately sabotaged their Declaration of Independence. So you have to be very careful. But in any event, the two-state solution was accepted in 1988, November 15. And ever since 15 November 1988, the Palestinians have been attempting in good faith to negotiate a two-state solution with Israel. And I work with them on that, and then I was legal advisor to the Middle East peace negotiations from 1991 to 93. Well, here we are, 1988 to 2012, 24 years later, and Israel is still continuing to gobble up the pizza. So the question will be, will the PLO Executive Committee, the Provisional Government of the State of Palestine, decide that officially that the two-state solution is no longer possible? Obviously, all their leaders have pointed this out, that at some point they will have to give up on it as a practical matter and revert to the PLO's original position before the Declaration of Independence of one democratic secular state for the entire mandate for Palestine. But on the other hand, as President Abbas pointed out, the recognition as a UN observer state is a step toward a two-state solution, right? I mean, if you support the two-state solution, you should support what President Abbas did, and indeed you should support full-fledged UN membership for Palestine in the United Nations organization, because then you would have two states, Palestine and Israel. So I, in all honesty, Michael, I can't say how this is.
No, I think that's very helpful to us. I mean, I think that.
But I think even though I don't necessarily agree with all the analysis, I think the best argument for the one-state solution is, of course, by Ali Abu Nim, who is behind me at the University of Chicago Middle East Studies Center.
Right, Ali's made those arguments exactly. That's right, in the
so
Electronic
I think
Intifada.
That's the best. Michael, we have to understand, this is for the Palestinians to decide.
Right. You and I aren't going to decide this.
By you, me, Professor Falk, the UN Special Rapporteur has come out in favor of one-state solution. He has no right to do that. Under Article 2, Paragraph 7 of the UN Charter, he is obligated to stay out of their domestic affairs. I think we all have to stand back and support the Palestinians and let them decide, you know, what they're going to do.
Okay, on that note, Francis, we're going to close this really important interview on what the significance is or was of the UN vote and on where we are now in terms of the UN and the Palestinian state and the various international organizations that Palestine can join.
Well, thank you very much, Michael, Heidi, and Michael, and keep up all that great work at the center and the National Lawyers Guild.
It's great. Good to talk to
Thanks.
You, Fran.
Bye-bye. Yeah,
take it easy.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook. Thank you.